Hi, this is Paul. We're going to talk about marriage.
What do you think about this lack of approach at the moment? Alexander, one of my friends, Alex Statesyke, put a study up recently. 50% of men aged 18 to 24 have never approached a woman in person in their life. And like even higher percentage, 18 to 30, haven't approached a woman in the last year.
Mm.
Is this downstream from Me Too?
I have a slightly weird take on this, which is that actually the thing you hear about as sort of the thing that Gen X people talk about of going up to someone in a bar and this being a way of striking up relationships, I think that was a very brief period of history, sort of post-sexual revolution, but pre-internet, where that was considered normal. And I'm slightly too young to have ever actually experienced that. The normal way, actually, that people start relationships in the vast majority of cultures is to be like, it is like semi-arranged marriage, right? Like, not the full, you've never met this person before, you know, 13-year-olds, whatever, getting betrothed, like, not like that. But the sort of you're introduced by family members, mutual friends, you're known in the community, you go to the same church, whatever it is. And then you're, both of your families, like, consent to the marriage and it works out okay. But the expectation isn't like... The expectation of marriage up until relatively recently was that you would have an economic relationship, and a reproductive relationship, but you weren't best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I don't think husbands and wives used to talk to each other as much as mm-hmm. they do now. I think people used to have much more homosocial kind of lives.
Mm-hmm.
You'd hang out with other men, you'd hang out with other women. You wouldn't necessarily hang out a lot with the opposite sex, including your spouse.
Okay, what you said there, I think, is true and super important, and it's super important on a whole number of ranges. One of the things I want to think about is sanity, marriage, gay marriage, because I remember when, in 2008, gay marriage was on the ballot in Sacramento, and some people asked me what I thought of it, and I told them, I said... Something has happened to the definition of marriage. And what she just said right here is super important.
But you weren't best friends. It works out okay. But the expectation isn't like... The expectation of marriage up until relatively recently was that you would have an economic relationship, a reproductive relationship, but you weren't best friends.
Mm-hmm.
Now, contrast that. Now, I'm not going to. Just watch The Bachelor or Bachelorette. All you hear in The Bachelor or Bachelorette is, I want to find my person. I want to find my best friend. And, you know, if you think you can get canceled publicly for saying certain things, you can get canceled. You can get canceled by women for saying what she just said. Now, what she just said is so important for understanding a lot of what has gone on in society. And I think part of the reason I think, and both of the videos I'm going to use here are from Chris. Chris is doing an amazing job with his interviews. If you notice, Chris doesn't start out his interviews, at least he doesn't start in terms of the recording of the interview, where it usually starts with, say a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself, blah, 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 blah. Chris, you know, it just starts right in the meat of the interview, which is very savvy in terms of a YouTube channel, because there's no sort of wading through the introduction to get to the meat of it. He just starts at the meat of it. He has the clips, so on and so forth. And Chris has also sort of become a journal of psychology with relevance realization to the types of issues that are very of the moment in the culture right now. And I mean, I think that's part of the reason Chris has had enormous success in a fairly short amount of time in terms of building his platform, because he has a real sense of asking the questions and getting interviewees to speak the truth, and sometimes even a very uncomfortable truth. And what she said right there now is contemporary heresy with respect to marriage. And for a whole range of reasons. If you would admit today that you're marrying predominantly for money, people will call you a gold digger if you're a woman. And for a man, again, men and women go into have traditionally gone into marriage for different reasons. Men have usually been the reason women so often can sort of marry up socioeconomically is because men usually select for all of the reasons. Now, 95% of the people who watch this channel are men. So you know how and why you're attracted to different women. Now, again, if you watch Chris Williamson, he'll say there's also a question in terms of ovulation in there, so which is a very interesting thing. But what you just said there is super interesting and important. Let's play a little bit more.
And actually, I don't think husbands and wives used to talk to each other as much as they do now. I think people used to.
And again, this is totally different now. I mean, even in that's at least evangelical churches. I don't know if in Orthodox churches, husbands and wives can ignore each other. I just don't think it can be done culturally because marriage has become such a different thing in terms of all of the other relationships. I mean, think about romance at work. Remember Jordan Peterson on the Vice thing asking if men and women could work together? I mean, this was just abject heresy. If this had been the 16th century, they would have had a stake right next to Servetus. That wasn't heresy then. It's heresy now. But to put poor old Jordan up on it.
They have much more homosocial kind of lives. Mm-hmm. You'd hang out with other men. You'd hang out with other women. You wouldn't necessarily hang out a lot with the opposite sex, including your spouse. So this idea that like the going up to a person in the bar is like the normal and natural way of starting relationships, I don't think is historically accurate.
But again, the really interesting thing was not the point she was making about going up to people in the bars. The real interesting thing of the comment was marriage has totally changed. And of course, gay marriage is such an interesting and such a conservative move in some ways because it is sort of a bringing people who are same-sex attracted into this fold. But of course, the fold is different too. The fold now is supposed to be, you know, this all-consuming fold. And long before I ever found Jordan Peterson, this is a blog post from May 14, 2012, Ernest Becker's book, Tim Keller read it, and used an excerpt and a sermon. And what I was doing back in 2012 is that I would listen to Tim Keller's sermons for illustrations because Tim Keller would give these deadly illustrations. And this was an illustration. And then I would sort of expand it and I would put it on my blog so I could find these things and use these things for my own sermon. Now, Peterson has talked about this book a fair amount. It's a Pulitzer Prize winning book in 1974. And it's talked about in chapter 8. Once we realized what the religious solution did, we can now see how modern man edged himself into an impossible situation. He still needed to feel heroic, to know that his life mattered in a scheme of things. So he sort of got the hero's journey here. He still had to be specially good for something truly special. He also had to merge himself with some higher self-absorbing meaning in trust and in gratitude. So you can see elements of the meaning crisis here in it as well. Interesting. What we saw in the universal motive of the agape merger. If he no longer had God, how was he to do this? One of the first ways that occurred to him, as Rank saw, was the romantic solution. He fixed his urge to cosmic heroism onto another person in the form of a love object. The self-glorification that he needed in his innermost nature, he now looked for in a love partner. The love partner became the divine ideal within which to fulfill one's life. And you can see this in this turn from when Louise Perry talks about what marriage used to be unto what marriage is now. It's this divine ideal. It's the divination of the romantic partner. And looking at the number of popular songs and the number of popular movies that concentrate on the divine ideal and the romantic partner, you can see why. And this, of course, also in terms of the conversation about gay marriage, well, why would you sort of not allow a same-sex person to participate in the divine ideal of a marriage partner? The love partner became the divine ideal within which to fulfill one's life. And again, if you listen to The Bachelor, Bachelorette, it's full of this stuff. And, you know, these are things that will get you canceled, not just sort of losing jobs and things, but get you canceled from the bedroom if you're a man, if you talk about these things. Fortunately, my wife doesn't watch the videos. She already knows how I think. I'll say that. Some of you are going to report, you should see what your husband said in this video. My wife would probably roll her eyes. And I know there's going to be comments here. The love partner became the divine ideal within which to fulfill one's life. All spiritual and moral needs now become focused in on the individual. Spiritually, which once referred to another dimension of things, is now brought down to earth and given form in another individual human being. Salvation itself is no longer referred to in an abstraction like God can be sought in the beatification of another. We would call this transference beatification. Man now lives in a cosmology of two. To be sure, all through history, there have been some competition between human objects of love and divine ones. We think of Eloise and Abelard, Alcibiades and Socrates, or even the Song of Solomon. But the main difference is that in traditional society, the human partner would not absorb into himself the whole dimension of the divine. In modern society, he does. In case we are inclined to forget how deified the romantic love object is, the popular songs continually remind us. They tell us that the lover is the springtime, the angel glow, with eyes like stars, and the experience of love that will be divine. Remember, he's writing in 1974, this is 50 years ago, and this has not changed almost at all. But again, it sort of continued to merge because the questions are, well, you know, is there still such a thing as marriage? Perhaps it is breaking. Let's go back to the beginning of the video. Because remember, he just jumps right in.
There's a Wall Street Journal column about marriage as a mirror of human nature that says 40% of young adults say marriage has outlived its usefulness. Mm. What do you think's going on?
I mean, I'm not surprised. Because these are young adults who've, like, I think in London now, and this would be true in lots of parts of the West, about half of kids will reach the age of 15 not living with their biological father. Half. So I guess these young people just look around and they're like, well, it's like evident to me that marriage isn't working.
Mary Eberstadt's got this idea about motherhood and family life as a mimetic desire.
Mm.
That the dearth of mothers and families causes fewer people to see them, which causes fewer people to want them, which causes fewer people to all the way down.
I think that's definitely true. And you can see that in data, actually, with, like, if your sister or your close friend has a baby, you're more likely to have a baby in the year or two following, and vice versa. So if the people around you are not having children, you're less likely to have children yourself.
Now, again, they're focusing now on the whole family thing. But a little bit later, is it this video or another, basically talks about, well, human beings, I'll find the quote. I'm a digger. Oh, it's right here by this one. We'll just keep going.
Now, I think people used to have much more homosocial kind of lives. Mm-hmm. You'd hang out with other men, you'd hang out with other women. You wouldn't necessarily hang out a lot with the opposite sex, including your spouse. So this idea that, like, the going up to a person in the bar is like the normal and natural way of starting relationships, I don't think is historically accurate.
That's interesting. So the male aversion felt fear of approach anxiety, which every guy listening is aware of, apart from the psychopaths, right? There is a girl that I find attractive that I either know or don't know or partly know or whatever.
Yeah.
Hi, how are you? Nice to meet you. Is kind of like a miniature war that you have to go to. And the felt sense of palpable fear is just ripping you apart inside. That isn't, or the modern aversion to that.
Just on a side note, what he says right there is very true. I sometimes wonder if, you know, I were single, if I would still have that, because part of it was just being young. Part of the beauty about marriage is, like, I haven't had that in my life for 37 years. I've been married 35 plus, going to be married 36 years this year. And it's like, it's so nice not to have to deal with that. Anyway.
Isn't some novel new problem. It was a, in your opinion here, a bar that kind of never really needed to be gotten over in the first place in some regards, because you had seen each other at church for ages, or her father owned the farm next to your father's land and you guys had known, blah, 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 like...
Yeah. People have much more kind of static social lives. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, just approaching some stranger and ending up getting married to her is not...
I had this conversation with a guy called Mads Larsen, who is a mating ideology researcher. I'll send it to you. It's phenomenal. And he talks about this... all of the different arrangements that people went through, and the romantic to the confluent, which is what we've moved through most recently, has left us with a really interesting vestige, which is previously it was they owned the farm next door. It was almost like a tactical marriage between the two of you. Mm-hmm. And then it's no. You guys are supposed to be together forever. You know, there is supposed to be deeper meaning instantiated in this. But then as soon as you have the sexual revolution, you have confluence. So for as long as you can benefit me and I can benefit you, I think even Mia Khalifa, who obviously paragon of sexual virtue, said on a recent interview that, people think that marriage is some sacred thing. It's not. It's just a piece of paper. And if this person isn't helping you grow, it's time to move on.
That's such an interesting thought, because helping you grow into this is romantic theosis. Is that what's going on?
Confluent, like, ideology there. You
helping
know,
you grow.
Front and center. You need to be helping them grow.
What does that mean?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
helping you prepare for your next porn scene. I don't know, whatever she meant.
And what struck me with, you know, when they're both expressed skepticism on that front, I thought, well, both of you are in the modern wisdom business. And the whole premise behind the modern wisdom business is helping you grow, but grow into what again? There's teleology involved there. You don't grow until you grow towards some ideal.
So you have this really interesting thing, which is that both the two most recent cultures have kind of got like conceptual inertia inside of our heads, that we have this sense, and we were kind of told, and maybe some people think that it's true, that you're supposed to find...
One of the ways that Chris is getting really good is... He articulated this in a recent thing. It might have been with, I don't remember who it was with. It might have been with Kissin. I do want to go back to that conversation too. But conceptual inertia, right there. Because he talks about having an idea and turning it into a meme. Conceptual inertia. It's a really good mimetic phrase.
Find a person who fulfills you, who is your confidant, your best friend, your the sexual paramour, the co-owner of your children and the household and all the rest of the things.
Yep.
And yet modern culture is this more confluence thing, which is they're supposed to benefit you and help you grow. And these two things kind of bounce off against each other. And then, you know, if we look...
It's transactional. And it's also it's instrumentalized. The person that isn't... The other person isn't a locus of value. The other person is instrumental for you. You're using the other person. But for what? Well, maybe for sex, maybe for personal development. You can dress it up for personal development, for money, for social mobility.
Back ancestrally, what we're predisposed for, it's fucking neither of those two, right? Like, you can say what you want about the truthfulness or utility of both of those. It wasn't that. And it seems like serial monogamy is what we're built for, some combination of polygyny and serial monogamy. And all of these...
And again, as with all of these things, there's sort of this this specter of evolutionary psychology out there that says, okay, the natural world is the telos. But of course, there's all these tensions in this, because the evolutionary psychologist par excellence on YouTube, evolutionary biologist, psychologist team par excellence on YouTube is, of course, the Hyings. And on one hand, they say, well, this is all what we're built for. But then they have all these other ideals that are up there and saying, well, we've got to make the transition. I have to remember to speak instead of just making hand motions, because a whole bunch of you are only listening to the recording of this. There still is sort of a nature-grace tension even in secularized American theology. It's very interesting.
Existing base rate of what we are plus the two most recent cultures are just like, yeah, like the Bermuda Triangle of mating ideologies inside of our mind.
Yeah, there's this book called The All or Nothing Marriage, which is about sort of, yes, this modern conception of marriage, where exactly this, you put so much expectation on your spouse that they will be, you know.
Uh-oh, I think someone's coming to look for me.
You will be perfectly sexually compatible, perfectly, like, conversationally compatible, you know, everything is perfect. And obviously for loads of people that isn't going to be true, and that's not going to be true for 60 years or whatever that you might be together. And so you end up with this all or nothing thing that, like, some people have absolutely fabulous marriages and some people just, they can't possibly take the strain and so they collapse. Mm. And the authors compare it to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Well, like, if you're in a situation of economic subsistence, you basically just see your spouse as like your economic partner with whom you have children, but your expectations are not that high. And then you reach the point where you're so affluent, right, contemporary culture, where you kind of regard marriage as, yes, as fulfilling all of these like esoteric psychological needs, which is just not reasonable. So I honestly, this again, Mary Harrington, endlessly quotable. She has this this saying that we should abolish big romance.
Yeah,
that the idea of having these incredible like romantic expectations of your spouse is just pretty much setting yourself up,
she's
up
just
to
a
fail.
One woman meme machine, isn't
yeah, she?
Yeah,
she really is.
All right, so there's this piece, and of course I read the romantic solution that goes on for a few paragraphs, essentially says what, I'll put the link to this. In 2012, I scanned this out of the book, or one way or another, I got it in. And again, it's the romantic partner is God. How can a human being be godlike? Everything for another. No human relationship can bear the burden of godhood. And the attempt has to take its toll in some ways on both parties. The reasons are not far to see. The thing that makes God the perfect spiritual object is precisely he is abstract, as Hegel saw. He is not a concrete individuality, and so he does not limit our development by his personal will and needs. Then we look for the perfect human object. We are looking for someone who has allowed us to express our will completely without any frustration or false notes. I quibble with some of that. You know, the people, the age of decay, people lose their beauty, people move on, yada yada yada. It's a problem. But now jump to this conversation.
Well, then the poor people are actually rich.
Absolutely. There's a report. I wanted to bring this to you. It's so interesting. So a recent report was released by the Harvard Graduate School of Education detailing the drivers of anxiety for young adults aged 18 to 25. 34% reported feelings of loneliness. 51% said achievement pressure negatively impacted their mental health. 58% reported lacking meaning or purpose in their lives in the last month. 50% reported that their mental health was negatively influenced by not knowing what to do with my life. Mm-hmm. There has been much examination of the well-being of teens aged 14 to 17. Not much has been known about those occupying the critical young adult years. And yet, young adults report roughly twice the rates of anxiety and depression as teens. The young adults mm-hmm. are not mm-hmm. okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, piece that with the one that he said about skepticism of marriage and the other piece that we did there. And so on one hand, you've got people that are, they're godless because they don't think the God on offer by the culture can actually come through for them. And on the other hand, maybe they're heading into this thinking that they're just one swipe away on Tinder from finding their God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe that. I saw even with my own kids that the when I was a kid, probably the time between 13 and 15 was the most difficult transition. But I saw that become older by the time my kids are 30 now, basically. By the time my kids were young adults, I could see that that transition into adulthood was the place where the difficulties were starting to mount. I think perversely that the therapeutic world has a fair bit to do with this, partly because therapists who are basically secular, liberal Protestants, that's a good way of thinking about them, tend to conceptualize mental health as mental, as subjective, right? It's like mental health is something you carry around in your head, like you carry around your identity. That's why we have these ridiculous ideas that you can just define your own identity. I am whoever I say I am. Well, obviously you're not, because other people have to go along with your game, their buddy, and they're either...
Again, there's another great quote in the other one, which I'll bring in.
It just doesn't play within the confines of reality.
Yeah.
Right.
And actually, that's one of the things that I think is so cruel about so much of the sort of discourse around trans. Like, there's this line, actually, there's this great, there's a writer called Andrew Long Chu, who is trans and who disagrees with me on absolutely everything, but I would say he's a great writer, right? Really, really good prose. And Chu has this line, when you are trans, you become permanently dependent on the kindness of strangers, in the sense that basically no one passes. It's really hard to pass convincingly, particularly if you transition as an adult. It'll always be kind of physically obvious that you're not actually a native female. What you depend on is people playing along every single time, every social interaction for the rest of your life, so as not to feel dysphoria. And sometimes people won't do that. Little children aren't going to do that. Or like some elderly person with Alzheimer's isn't going to do that. You know, people aren't always going to cotton on that they're supposed to play along.
Yeah.
And so it means you have this incredibly fragile...
Yeah, it's a social minefield.
It's terrible. Yeah, and what you're basically... And that's what's being inflicted on people when they're encouraged to go through irreversible surgeries. Living their entire life dependent on the kindness of strangers to avoid complete psychological dissolution.
Douglas Murray's...
Wow. Anyway, back to the other.
They're going to do that. They're not going to do it. Or they're going to do it voluntarily. Or they're going to do it by force. If they're not going to do it, you're screwed. If you have to use force, that's not going to work. And if you want them to do it voluntarily, then it's not going to be all about you. Obviously. Even no four-year-old can find someone to play with if he always gets to pick the game. Okay, so... why might young adults be lost? Well, part of it is that they're thinking, I'm not trying to be judgmental of a whole generation. It's a form of thought. Your mental health isn't dependent on you. That's not the right way to think about it. I don't think you can be mentally healthy in the absence of a long-term stable relationship. So you have to be married. Let's make that part of the precondition for successful adaptation as a young adult. Yeah.
Now remember the other relationship we've just said, is marriage viable? Is this, well, it's trade-offs. It's essential. It's a skill you're going to have to learn, but it's a skill you're going to have to learn. Part of what I believe Jesus says and means in the Gospels is that this world is insufficient. And it is a world of trade-offs. And I think this is part of Lewis's argument from desire, where we desire a world without trade-offs. Well, naturally, and you can argue that. That doesn't necessarily mean, you know, ontology. Well, this is sort of the ontological argument too. And so let's hear Peterson some more on this, because he's right.
You have to be married. So you have to establish a relationship with someone that integrates sexuality, that's there for the long run. Because there for the long run is the same as sane. There for tomorrow, there for the next minute, that's not sanity, that's impulsiveness. That's aimlessness. They're the same thing. If it's all about what you want right now, or more accurately, all about what something in you wants this moment, That's the definition of immature insanity. You have to commit. So you commit to someone else, you commit to your family, you commit to your community. Like, there are multiple levels of identity that stretch out into the social world. And voluntarily adopting those levels of hierarchical responsibility gives you an identity. It gives you a purpose. It protects you from anxiety. It does that in all sorts of ways. Like, you know, you said earlier that one of the things you do is seek for validation, and you related that to uncomfortable experiences you had when you were very young. Well, it might not be precisely that you're seeking for validation. You might be properly investigating how you should be embedded in a social hierarchy at every possible level. It's like, well, people think their mental health is something that they just carry around in their head, and that if they just got the way they looked at the world right, or if other people just played their game, that all of a sudden they'd be mentally healthy. It's like, there's no difference between thinking about yourself and being miserable. Technically, if you look at, you can group.
Now, he made this claim at the O2, which was interesting, and I think it's valid, but you have to understand that there's a particular sense of thinking of yourself. And it's because there's more nuance to it than just that. But the way he phrases it is obviously mimetically powerful.
Descriptive statements about yourself statistically. All the descriptors that are reflective of self-consciousness load on negative emotion.
Can you not think about yourself in a positive way?
Probably not.
Really?
Not. Well, let's take that apart. You like doing your podcast and you feel positive about it. Okay, but your podcast isn't about you. Right? So if you're thinking about how you're of utility to a broad number of people, you know, maybe you would take some satisfaction in that, but that isn't exactly thinking about yourself, is it? It's thinking about the relationship you've established with other people, and it's a relationship of responsibility. Why do you like your podcast? You can pursue what you're curious about, but you wouldn't have to do that publicly. Okay, so why do you do it publicly?
For a few reasons. First one being that it keeps me accountable. That was one of the main reasons, that it kept me accountable, because I knew that if I didn't do it, if I wasn't rigorous and precise and aligned.
This is interesting. Now, again, I'm going to want to talk about through the miracle of recording. It's been hours since I stopped, such as my life, but. It's interesting because, again, I've been watching a lot of Chris lately, and Chris, you know, has really sort of worked very hard, clearly, on this interview thing, and also he's on this quest. It's sort of a, you know, it's almost a contemporary adaptation of the Book of Proverbs, in that it's not Proverbs that he's recording, but it's memes.
With what I'd said and done previously, that there was an external eye that's watching.
Okay, that okay. So, well, that's very interesting. So I would also say that's not exactly about you. That's about your ability to live, to establish harmony between what you say and the way you act and the expectations that an increasingly broad social community has of you as a consequence of what you say and how you act. Okay.
Now, this isn't disconnected with marriage. And it's not disconnected with sort of an at-will approach to marriage. In the Exodus series, they will talk about helpmeet, which is a term in Hebrew that has been fought over endlessly. As Dennis Prager sort of has a like adversary, and in some ways. Marriage does that. Now, one of the things that I didn't talk about when he first started on this is Peterson almost equates here marriage with sanity. Now, a lot of jokes could come out of that. But part of what's going on here too is we have the rise of individualism, the rise of isolation, domicide, and all of those issues. And so people increasingly, like never before in human history, and a large scale, live alone. And I don't mean just living in a domicile alone, mean live isolated lives. This has been something that has been growing through the 20th century. If you go to Google, you can look at countries in the world where with the smallest households. And again, it tends to correlate with westernization, with wealth, with individualism. And Peterson has actually been developing this theme about the relationship between sanity, that sanity isn't just sort of between your ears, it's between all of us, and it's deep in the society.
That's not about you. That's about your nesting in a social hierarchy, right? And so I think you can, and then you might say too, well, maybe you're thinking about yourself when you're establishing an aim or a goal. Well, not if they're good aims or goals, because if they're good aims or goals, and I would say what good means technically is an aim or goal that will play out well in the medium to long term across a multitude of situations, including many, many people. So a solution that
early on in 2018, Peterson, you'd often talk about Piaget and this equilibrated state. You'd hear that in his classes, and now he's sort of dropped that and he's fleshed it out. And what he's been doing is sort of reconnecting everything, because there is a telos involved, and it sort of goes all the way up to God. Different place in this, he'll talk about the relationship between, you know, sort of the summum bonum, you know, the three transcendentals.
Iterates across time, that is situation independent, and that's broadly socially inclusive, is a better aim, right? It's a higher aim because it integrates more. All right, now you might want to be setting up aims, and you might be pleased about how you're progressing in relation to those aims. But if those aims don't have the characteristics that I just described, then if the aims have the characteristics I just described, they're not about you. And then we could also ask, what do you mean about you? Exactly. What you are you talking about here?
Now, remember, this video is about marriage. And I mean, some people speak in sentences. Some people speak in paragraphs. Peterson tends to speak in pages. But this is all along the line to marriage is in many ways not about you. I'm finishing up the 8-part series, finally getting around to the 8-part series and the rest is history on the fall of the Aztecs. And I've enjoyed every episode. I really love it when they go deeper and go long. But all of these things, you know, then you've got Cortez and, you know, he was forced to marry this woman in Cuba. Of course, he goes to Mexico and against the orders and illegally, you know, basically overturns the Aztec Empire, yada, 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 stays away for years. Eventually, his wife catches up to him and in all likelihood murdered her one night so that he could continue to carry on with his mistresses and continue to do what he wanted. And he didn't want to marry her anyway. But marriage has always had this quality of it isn't about you. And so even in sort of this modern adaptation that, well, you should be with someone who makes you grow. Well, the you that should grow isn't just the one enveloped in terms of your skin. It's the you that goes out quite a bit further into the world. And marriage is sort of a strange discipline that can do that. But again, I want to, you know, the point that I didn't make earlier, that not everyone should get married. The Apostle Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 7. And it's not a bad thing to not get married. Part of what happened after the Protestant Reformation in the West is that the home sort of, it sets up what Ernest Becker calls this divination of the spouse. But you know, what Peterson is putting together says, well, this isn't disconnected from heaven and earth, let's say.
You know, and so we play these identity games in the modern world that are making people anxious and hopeless. And one identity game is, I'm defined by my sexuality. Okay, so let's take that. I'm defined by my sexuality. Okay, but what do you mean by your sexuality exactly? Do you mean the opportunity to engage in sex? Like, are you reducing sexuality as such to the act of sex? Okay, let's say you are. So now what you're telling me is that who you are is who you are when you're sexually desirous. That's what you've reduced yourself to. But it's even more than that. It's the kind of sexual desire that wants gratification right now with no relationship whatsoever. So not only have you now reduced who you are to your sexual desire, you've reduced your sexual desire to the minimal set of preconditions that would satisfy it. Well, then the first question that might come up there is, why not just use porn? It's a lot simpler. And the answer to that is what people are doing. Well, it's no wonder that they're anxious and lonesome and aimless, because they've reduced themselves to a short-term desire. They found the easiest.
Now, remember where this started. And you always have to remember that with Peterson, because it's a long way around. He said, well, young people are hopeless and aimless. Well, yeah, no wonder.
Possible way of gratifying that. And they've abandoned everything that would be a much broader conceptualization of what sexuality would be if it was embedded properly in, well, how about a relationship to start with? And I'm not just, these aren't just opinions. So there are two different strategies of reproduction broadly in the animal world. One is zero investment. Fish, mosquitoes, million offspring, they all die but one, right? So you can reduce reproduction in mosquitoes basically to sex. And you make a million mosquito offspring, all you need is one to survive, problem solved. Okay. On the opposite end of the spectrum, literally, are human beings, because we have the longest dependency period of any animal by a large margin. We have a high investment strategy, sexual reproduction strategy. So whatever sex is for human beings isn't you're off and that's over. That's not what it is for human beings. It's embedded in a relationship. Now, you might say, well, we could pull sexuality out of the relationship and just indulge in it for the pleasure. Okay, so now let's forget about all the other animals. Now we've got two types of human being. We've got the one-night stand human being, repetitive one-night stands, and we've got the long-term committed relationship human being. And then we might ask, okay, what are the personality characteristics of the people in those bins? So let's go to the short-term one-night stand sequential relationship types. Okay, who are they? Psychopathic, narcissistic, Machiavellian, and sadistic.
All one-night stand people?
If they don't start out that way, they're going to end that way. Right? Because you can't use yourself.
It's the formation question again. And that's finally where it comes down to, is what are you forming? And that formation isn't just personal formation, like personal growth in the Louise Perry, you know, personal growth going to help you grow. No, it's formation actually of an entire community.
Self or other people for short-term gratification. Look, the definition of a psychopath is someone who uses someone for short-term gratification. Okay, so it's definitional, right? So, and then you might say, well, I'm not like that. I just like sex. It's like, yeah, but if you practice that for 5 years, you're not going to become what you practice. You know, and I talked to Russell Brand about this a little bit on, and I can say,
because of course, this is exactly what Russell Brand did.
Say this because it was on his podcast, so it's not like this is secret, you know.
Maybe you should talk more about it with Russell Brand. And, you know, with everything Russell Brand has been through, he's probably got regrets about how he spent a number of years.
Russell had what Andrew Tate promises his followers. He had fame, he was charismatic, and he had more or less unlimited access to short-term sexual gratification. Okay, in combination with, you know, the chemicals that make that even more likely. alcohol and cocaine, let's say. So what are the consequences? Well, I asked him, what were the consequences? You had this. He said, despair, anxiety, and hopelessness. Right, but not just that, because, you know, Russell got himself in trouble here a month and a half ago, just about took him out. Well, it was his past coming back to haunt him. Like, and he had to scroll through his psyche and see, you know, well, in with all these short-term relationships, these short-term sexual gratification binges that I indulged in, did I ever cross the line? Well, the answer is, well, you're going to have like 200 encounters like that. And you're not going to cross the line when you're drunk, when you're on cocaine. You're going to cross a bunch of lines and then it's going to come back and haunt you. And so it's very interesting to see in our culture, back to the hopelessness and despair that you were mentioning that's characterizing young adults' life. It's like, well, it's all about me. That's the self-esteem movement. But then me becomes, it's all about what I want. And then that becomes, it's all about what I want right now. Then it's what the lowest part of me wants right now, and to hell with everyone else. It's like, okay, how are you going to play that game without being desperate? You're going to be desperate as soon as you start playing that game. And the other thing, it's even worse than that, because you're going to end up with Jeremy, the porn star problem. Anybody, you're not going to be very happy about being with the people who want to play that game with you, because they're not going to be the people that are really going to make you feel that life is worth living. They're going to be the people, especially on the female side, women who are willing to take advantage of themselves for short-term sexual gratification. Those aren't happy women. They're usually damaged women. And if they're not damaged when they start playing that game, they're going to be plenty damaged by the time they're done with it.
The last time that we spoke, me and you talked about population decline, and the Census Bureau just released today predicting that the U.S. population will decline for the first time ever by the year 2100 after peaking in 2080. So their estimates showed that the U.S. population, which is about 333 million at the moment, is expected to reach 370 by 2080, but will be back down to 366 by 20.
Again, it's interesting because, you know, the more I watch Chris, the more I sort of get a sense of his patterns. And it's these data points, but it's data points and wisdom. And I was thinking a lot about the contemporary relationship with statistics. As statistics aren't a very old discipline. And part of what we're wrestling now is dealing with our worldview, our picture of the world. And the screens are sort of disrupting this. And at the beginning of the 20th century, statistics were statistics, mass media. There was a confidence in the big picture, that the big picture could give us an accurate picture and give us the ability to navigate. And it was sort of a science was supposed to do the same thing. That's a big piece of what's been coming apart in terms of sense making. We've seen that with the medical establishment, with COVID, with other diseases, autoimmune diseases that, you know, I regularly now bump into people who have had different autoimmune diseases. It could be Lyme's disease, Barr-Epstein, chronic fatigue, now long COVID, and you have all of this, it's really the deconstruction of statistics. And we're trying to navigate by these statistics, but very quickly we realize that people have a very funny relationship with statistics. On one hand, they're like, yeah, I believe in statistics. And, you know, if it says the majority of people, blah, 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 and then they go out and buy a lottery ticket and someone says, I thought you said you believed in statistics. Yeah, but I could be the one. I'm going to end this piece here because it's, you know, basically, I don't know how long the overall interview was. The recording was 2 hours and 32 minutes. It could have been a longer because, you know, there could very well have been editing in there. Maybe I'll finish with Becker in this last paragraph. After all, what is it that we want when we elevate the love partner to the position of God? We want redemption, nothing less. We want to be rid of our faults, of our feelings of nothingness. We want to be justified, to know that our creation has not been in vain. We turn to the love partner for the experience of the heroic, for perfect validation. We expect them to make us good through love. Needless to say, human partners can't do this. The lover does not dispense cosmic heroism. He cannot give absolution in his own name. The reason is that as finite beings, he, too, is doomed, and we read that doom in his own fallibilities, in his very deterioration. Redemption can only come from outside the individual, from beyond, from our conceptualization of the ultimate source of things, the perfection of creation. And what I like, you know, where Peter, what Peter said, so Louise Perry sort of pulls the illusion off of the romantic myth and says, you know, for most of human history, people, you know, marriage was one part of the overall project, and it had economics, it had family, it had community, it had sex. It was sort of one package that did a bunch of things for you, but it wasn't divinized. It wasn't expected to be all end all. Suddenly we hit this prosperity, and we're no longer, now we're just marrying for pleasure. And then we begin to realize that marriage for pleasure doesn't really work, because you can read Tim Keller's book on marriage. Marriage isn't really designed for pleasure. Now, marriage can give a great many goods, but it's not the kind of goods that, let's say, listening to a recording of a piano can give you. It's more like the goods of learning to play the piano, because learning to play the piano is full of discipline and hardship and practice. Now, and it's also the case that not all marriages are happy. Some marriages are difficult. And again, as a pastor, and marriages have different seasons. There can be marriages that can be very bad and very difficult and turn out to be very good and fulfilling. That's not uncommon either. But it's a different kind of thing than a consumer good. And what Peter said about psychopaths, in a sense, not only do we have a narcissistic society, but we have a psychopathic society, because that tends to be how we use each other. Redemption can only come from outside the individual, from beyond, from our conceptualization of the ultimate source of things, the perfection of creation. It can only come, as Rank says, when we lay down our individuality, give it up, admit our creatureliness and helplessness. What partner would ever permit us to do this, would bear us if we did? The partner needs to be as God. On the other hand, what partner could ever want to give redemption, unless he was mad? Even the partner who plays God in the relationship cannot stand it for long, as that at some level he knows that he does not possess the resources that the other needs and claims. He does not have perfect strength, perfect assurance, secure heroism. He cannot stand the burden of godhood, and he must resent the slave. Beside the uncomfortable realization must always be there, how can one be a genuine God if one's slave is so miserable and unworthy? In Christian marriage, the image, again, in the book of Ephesians, is one of basically people lay down their lives for each other. Now, there are limits to that. Not everyone should marry. Not every marriage should go to term. That's true. But without the ideal, without the vision, and without that vision being in some ways embedded in, and Peterson was sort of pointing to it, in a much bigger wholeness, a much bigger well-being, it's going to struggle. So the romantic image doesn't hold. The utilitarian image, you shouldn't use others. Again, I tend to think, big surprise, the pastor thinks the Christian image is the right one. There you go. That's the reveal at the end of the video. I'm sure you were you found to be unexpected, but here we are. Anyway, I thought the juxtaposition between the two videos was really interesting. So let me know what you think.